Hello, my name is John Calladine, and welcome to this podcast on the basics of auditing of charities. This podcast is not meant to talk about all the various rules and regulations of charity auditing, but to give you a practical guide on particular issues involved. In the charity sector, the thresholds for auditing are so much lower, leaving a market there for accountants, or at least areas where you can gain experience. Charities with total income and resources of £500,000 and above are required to have a full audit by a statutory auditor. You may consider this low, but of course we are dealing with public money and accountability is required. In addition, if the charity's income is above £250,000 and its gross assets exceed £3.26 million, then a full audit is also required. Definition of gross assets is assets as per the balance sheet, and these include all fixed and current assets. You may think this is not a problem, but many smaller charities, and especially churches, can easily have a freehold property in the balance sheet above that figure. Prior to the Charities Act 1993, many unregistered charities did not produce or had no full records. Since the Charities Act 1993, charities and churches have had to put their house in order with the production of full statutory accounts. One problem that has arisen is that many charities and churches have no record of original cost of their properties. It has therefore meant that properties have been included and shown at valuation, or indeed in some cases, insurance valuation. Once you have a figure in the balance sheet, you are stuck with it, and it has to be revalued each year. The revaluation of properties may take the charity over the asset test. However, returning to the subject of when an audit is necessary, it is not only the threshold that has to be considered. The auditor accountant needs to look at the memorandum and articles of association if it is a limited company, or the trust deed if it is an unincorporated charity, and see what the rules and regulations say. In many cases, a charity may well have written into its original constitution that a full audit is required by a statutory auditor. Where a charity was formed before 1993, the trust deed can be misleading. Quite often, it may just say an audit is required. But of course, an audit prior to 1993 was somewhat different to the world in which we live now. The Charities Act 1993 brought in the need for an independent examination for all charities, with the current threshold level being £25,000 and above, to a total of £500,000. If the trust deed states that an audit is necessary and it was formed before 1993, it is possible to write to the Charity Commission and ask for a dispensation not to have an audit carried out, assuming, of course, the charity is within the threshold level. A further consideration is to look at the rules and reporting requirements of funders. Very often, statutory funders or other grant-making charities may actually ask the beneficiary charity to have an audit carried out to ensure that the funds and monies donated are being used correctly. With a threshold level of £500,000, cut-off is important. And if you are the accountant or potential auditor looking at a charity with income just below that level, work will be necessary in the area of cut-off. What do I mean by cut-off? Looking at transactions before and after the year end, particularly in the areas of income. A charity with income of £499,000 and below may well suppress income to avoid an audit. Do not be naive to think that this does not happen. What goes on in the business world also goes on in the charity world, and with the potential cost of auditing so high, the charity will look to whatever means possible to keep its income below the £500,000 threshold. Potential arrears of gift aid claims may need recognising, and a debtor here may take the charity over the threshold level. A further complication now is under what Act is the audit being carried out? If the charity is unincorporated, that is, not a company charity, then there is no confusion. It's the Charities Act 1993. Incidentally, the auditing certificate will be signed off in the name of the firm. It is only the Companies Act 2006 which brought in the new term of senior statutory auditor. If, however, you are dealing with a company charity, there are alternative options. You can either have the audit carried out under the Companies Act 2006, the audit being signed off by the senior statutory auditor, or under the Charities Act 1993, with the audit being signed off by the firm. If the audit is under the Charities Act 1993, then a statement may well be necessary on the balance sheet, stating that the company charity is exempt from audit under the Companies Act 2006, because it is below the commercial world threshold. All very confusing, but areas which need to be considered. We are now entering the realms of planning. Before we get there, we have to address the issue of funds. Charities are somewhat unique, with different types of funds or divisions, if that is a better word to use. There are unrestricted funds, usually called the general fund of the charity, the day-to-day work or the core work. There are designated funds, where money is put aside by a charity and designated accordingly. This could be a roof repair fund, money designated for a particular purpose, or set aside for projects and designated accordingly, but they remain unrestricted. We now then need to address what is called restricted funds. Restricted funds are those given for a purpose that is narrower than the general objects of the charity, but still fall within the specific requests as determined by the donor. These could be for specific projects or other purposes and are restricted. That money has then to be kept and controlled within the separate restricted fund. It is important to note that a charity cannot act outside the objects as set out in its trust document. Therefore, if it is a narrowly defined charity, that charity can only act within the words of the objects. If a charity is set up for the welfare of dogs, then it cannot act in the welfare of other animals. If a charity is set up for animal welfare and money is specifically given to the welfare of dogs, then that has to be restricted to its own fund. It is advisable when acting for a charity to suggest that the charity keeps its marketing material widely worded. If not, then the specific appeals, for example, for a new building fund or other specific project, make the money restricted. Funds which are held on trust for the future benefit of the charity are endowment funds. If the capital cannot be spent, although it can rise and fall in value, it is a permanent endowment. If the capital sum can be spent in prescribed circumstances, it is an expendable endowment. It is important with the different type of funds to ensure that income is allocated correctly to either the restricted or unrestricted or designated fund. Auditing tests will need to be carried out to ensure that the charity is recording its income correctly in accordance with the wishes of its donors. Let's now turn to planning aspects. Certainly, I've always found it helpful to do a company search at Companies House for company charities, and of course also to look at the Charity Commission website. This is free and much information can be downloaded about the charity. It should always be part of the auditor's planning and auditing work to read the charity literature. All charities will have some form of promotional literature, and almost certainly in the IT world of today, a website. And if it is a local charity, there may be articles written about it in the local press. Read these articles. Find out what the activities of the charity are and what is advertised on the website. This is so important, and you need to ensure it is part of the audit. A fundamental principle of charity auditing is to ensure that the charity is acting within its objects and carrying out activities in accordance with its constitution. This does not happen within the commercial world, as articles of association are not specific, but relate to commercial activities in general. Failure of a charity to act within its objects requires a whistleblowing report to the Charity Commission, to which I refer later. Why not Google the charity and obtain as much local knowledge as you can? Referring to the marketing material, see if the charity are seeking to raise funds and whether any specific appeals have been made. Are these appeals narrowly defined and therefore will be subject to a restricted fund rather than to core giving? It is all part of the work of the auditor to build a picture of the work of the charity. As with business audits, flowchart the organisation, its activities, its staff, its financial systems. With the smaller charity, there may not be any senior staff, but almost certainly with income over £500,000, there may be a chief executive or some other staff, and appropriate meetings with them will be useful as part of your audit. One of the most important parts of a charity audit is the recognition of income. I say this because it can be so hard to prove income for a charity where so many charities are dependent upon voluntary donations, even street donations or church offerings, for example. Flowchart the system, finding out how money is received, how it is accounted for and recorded, and how it is banked. Ensure there are proper controls and procedures. How do you prove money given through church offertory bags or collections? First, you need to ensure there is a system, double counting of the money, dual control of banking. Ensure these systems are monitored. Many donors give by standing order, which brings some measure of control. Consider cross-referencing to the gift aid records and gift aid declaration certificates. I remember a charity where the principal was all members tithed, that is, donated 10% of their income to the charity. As auditors, we took an average income of the members and looked to see if 10% applied was close to the total donations recorded. When considering recognition of income, the three words certainty, measurement and entitlement are so important. Is the charity entitled to the money? Is it certain that it is going to receive the money? And can the money be measured in financial terms? In the case of legacies, consider a charity's entitlement to a residuary legacy of an estate. There is certainty and entitlement, but no measurement. And therefore, until such figures can be ascertained, the money will not be recognised to the SOFA. However, if it was a specific legacy, then it would be recognised. A particular area of concern with auditing the income of charities would be grants charities receive in respect of grants for specific projects. This may come from government funding or other charities. It is always advisable to read the paperwork and the conditions for the grant. It is not unknown for paperwork to say that grants will be repaid in the event of the charity failing to fulfil the contract. Care is needed in relation to project funding and other monies received for specific events. The income may need to be deferred at the balance sheet date. In other words, money may well have been received, but the event or project has not been carried out. Rather than recognise this income to the SOFA and carry it forward as a fund balance, a better accounting policy would perhaps be to defer it to the balance sheet as a current liability and not to recognise it to the SOFA until such time as the project has been fulfilled. A further auditing difficulty or risk area is in relation to transactions with trustees. It has always been a fundamental of charity law that trustees do not get paid but give their services to the charity and community voluntarily. However, this has perhaps been eroded over recent years with our change of culture and the need for more specialist advice and higher standards of reporting and accountability. It is not uncommon now to find that many trustees are paid, whether they are professional advisors or whatever. Indeed, sometimes with a charity, the chief executive may be appointed as a trustee. The Charities Act 2006 does allow this, and most modern memorandum and articles of association will incorporate clauses to allow for the payment to trustees. However, full disclosure is necessary under the SORP, and the auditor should be aware of this. I should now refer to related party transactions. It is not uncommon for there to be payments or transactions with various persons connected with the trustees, either family members or businesses. Careful scrutiny of the records and inquiries will need to be made to ensure that full disclosure is made. We now turn to items of expenditure. As with income, it is important to ensure that expenditure is allocated correctly to the different charitable activities being undertaken. It is quite conceivable that the charity may have various ongoing projects, some of which are particular restricted funds. The auditor will need to ensure that tests are carried out to see that expenditure is allocated correctly to the specific funds involved. This follows from the very important principle that the charity must act within its objects. If money is given for a specific purpose, then the corresponding expenditure must be allocated accordingly. I mentioned this earlier, but it is now a statutory responsibility upon an auditor that any areas of material concern discovered by him are reported to the Charity Commission. This could be acting outside the objects of the charity, but it also includes areas of fraud, breaches of control, money laundering, etc. Fundamentally, if the issue concerns you and it is material, it should be disclosed to the Charity Commission. There is also a discretionary right to write a report to the Commission where the auditor still considers the matter serious. Going concern relates just as much to a charity as to a commercial venture. It is perhaps even more prevalent in our current economic climate, with major cutbacks in the public sector and reduced government spending. Monies which previously would have been allocated to charities may well now dry up, and many organisations may find themselves unable to sustain their ongoing charitable projects. Care should be taken in relation to the audit to ensure that a charity has sufficient contracts and funding in place to maintain its levels of expenditure and activities. It is not unusual to find that the general fund of a charity is short of money. This is because money is given for specific projects and not for the core work of the charity. An overdrawn general fund is a sign of insolvency. I now turn to trading. Many charities get involved in trading activities, primarily to raise funds for the work. However, trading activities which are connected with the core work of the charity, called primary purpose trading, cause no particular problem. They are regarded as an integral part of the work. This could be, for example, providing counselling services, or running a shop for the purposes of training vulnerable adults, or helping the skills of those wanting to return to work. If the purpose of the shop is to promote the work of the charity and not to raise funds, this is primary purpose trading. What does cause difficulty is trading activities, particularly for the purpose of raising money, charity shops, cafes, etc. A charity is allowed by the Charity Commission to have a maximum of 25% of its income derived from trading activities to a maximum of £50,000 per annum. Anything in excess of that figure is not allowable and should be moved to a trading subsidiary company. Auditors should therefore consider the various trading activities of the charity to ensure that they comply with the primary purpose of its objects. If there is a trading subsidiary, there may well be auditing issues for the trading subsidiary, and indeed, one then has to consider group accounts. There are, of course, many other areas to consider, but I hope this introduction to charity auditing is of help. Thank you for listening to this podcast.